Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest today is Nancy Bilyeu. She is the author of The Fugitive Colors. It's a sequel to her novel, The Blue. Nancy was born in Chicago, Illinois, and grew up in Michigan. She studied English literature and American history at the University of Michigan, earning a bachelor's degree before moving to New York City to work in the magazine business. The Fugitive Colors is her sixth novel. And Nancy, welcome back to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Oh, it's so great to be back and to talk to you.
So Nancy, I referred to you in a tweet recently as the master of historical novels.
Wow. I have to be worthy of this. Thank you.
That is and so once nice again, you put us in a fascinating period of time in the United Kingdom or Great Britain or England, whatever of those names apply. So this is post the French Indian War. Famously, George Washington served in the English Army during that particular war. This is pre-American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And this is under King George. So share with me, how do you so seamlessly weave into the fabric of this novel the history of what's going on at this point in time?
Well, that's something that I really enjoy doing, and it is quite a challenge because I want to take a reader and immerse them in this world, but I don't want to do it in a way that you'll stop and think about the history or the philosophy or this person or that person. I just want it to be a seamless experience as much as I can. So what I try to do is I try to bring the description and I try to bring, you know, everything, the dialogue, the action into one, it's kind of hard to explain, but into one path. So I don't stop and say, oh, this is what this building looked. Oh, wait, there's Mozart. You know, I don't do that.
In other words, you don't do an exposition dump.
Yes, I've been, that is my quest in life, never to do that, to try and keep it moving. But at the same time, you know, I know that a lot of very successful thriller authors have very, very taut writing where it's really, and they have good characters sometimes, but that's really, really plot is driving. And although I like to think I have good plots and I outline very feverishly and try to keep the pace going, I really feel like the characters drive it. And especially my main character. And her
Genevieve,
her ambitions and her flaws and her mistakes and her good qualities are what makes things evolve the way they do. So that's, I feel like if you have a character who you really feel comfortable with as a writer and you have them in a good setting, then, you know, you can sort of drive that carriage, you know what I mean? It's like, let's see what happens. So even though I do outlines, they change a lot always, because as I'm in it and she's interacting with people, some characters, it's almost like a play. Some get more lines, some get less lines, and it changes. But I do a lot of research, and then I don't use all of it, but I kind of have it in here. And I read books. I read, I go to JSTOR and I read, like, I get a lot out of like 80-year-old academic journals.
Wow.
Sort of obscure archaeological or historical journals. I found a out of print Joshua Reynolds biography that was super helpful. And for this book, believe it or not, I read my first real scientific research on the air quality of London, which was very bad in 1764. And so I just didn't want to do the cliched obvious fog. There's fog. You know, I wanted to know, why was the air so bad? What was in the air? What did it look like? What did it smell like? What did it feel like to walk through? So I actually read a scientific journal that talked about the exact levels of coal and what kind of coal and why there was so much. And the fact that England had won a war with France and had more money meant that more people had coal, meant that there was more pollution. So, you know, interesting stuff like that, you know, and I don't know, you know, I don't come out and say that. But I sort of have it in my head when I'm writing a lot of this stuff that I read.
So Genevieve Planchet, now Genevieve Sturbridge. So mm-hmm. since the first novel, The Blue, she's actually married now.
Right.
But she is a woman living in a time. She's an aspiring painter. But mm-hmm. I believe women are not allowed to attend the Academy of Painters. So thwarted ambition. She's a Huguenot. The King of France decided to go back on their word to give religious freedom to the Huguenots in France. So she's part of, she's a descendant of Huguenots that immigrated to England. So she's a Huguenot. She's a woman. And at this point in time, painters and artists depend on the wealthy to patronize them. So she has a lot of barriers that she's facing. Talk a bit about creating a character and continuing this character into the new novel who faces so many different barriers.
Yes. Well, I didn't. And this is where, you know, research can could sometimes like be a blessing because I knew that I wanted to have a woman in the first book who had knowledge of art. And so as I but I didn't really know exactly what that would entail. I knew about women writers like Mary Wollstonecraft. In the 18th century, and there are some writers earlier. I didn't know that much about artists, and then when I researched them, that's when I saw that there were more barriers than I realized because women could do watercolor and even oils, could do some dabbling. They could do it as part of their effort to be decorative wives or interesting young ladies to court. But as far as expressing something through art, no. Because the main thing is that art then was extremely technical and needed an enormous amount of training and craft to get the proportions, the colors. You had a lot of human figures and you really needed to use models. And that was where the big obstacle came up because women were not allowed to take classes in which there would be a nude model. And also there was this prejudice, and I did sneak this into a line of this book, that they felt that it was unseemly for women to even paint paintings because they would have to stare at the men in a bold way for a sustained period. And that made men uncomfortable. And also there was just this feeling that it's just not what women should be doing. It was a very hard time to be a woman in the 18th century, even though there was enlightenment and there was a lot of adventure and a lot of sexual exploration. But as far as actually like ordinary women earning a living, very tough. Servant, maybe, if you're not a wife, a very difficult time. So I had her in a refugee community. I think that we talked about this last time, the word refugee actually was coined to describe the French Huguenots when they moved to London. They came up with a name for them, and it's now grown to be a word that everybody knows. And even though England embraced the French Protestants more than many countries embrace immigrants, there was still some resentment that they were taking jobs away, you know, the eternal thing. That like these very ambitious silk weavers and artisans, and they were silversmiths, they made glasses, they were doctors and dentists. And there was this feeling like they're taking jobs away from English people. So there was some tension, some scorn, you know, about you'll go on a block and you'll just hear French, you know, who do they think they are? You know, I mean, these things are echoed now, you know, this sort of prejudice and dislike because of taking jobs away. So she's in a community that is sort of, and the English in the, for many centuries were very xenophobic. They didn't really like foreigners in general, maybe because they're on an island. And then, so she has to deal with that. And then she has to deal with being a woman who really wants to be a fine artist, to be a creative person saying something with her art. And there's just almost no precedent for it. You know, there's the only exceptions that I could find were people who had artist fathers who taught them everything they knew and sort of protect. You had to have a father or a husband. You absolutely couldn't do it on your own. And, you know, which is kind of unfortunate, to say the least.
Well, let me jump in here, because one of the things I really find fascinating about that time period is all the political intrigue between France and England at that point in time. There's a lot of spying going on back and forth. And what happens to Genevieve and her, the characters, is they're pawns without even knowing it.
Yes. No, it's true. What happened was France had been the dominant country. And Louis XIV, the Sun King, was seen as like nothing that had ever been seen before. And he made France the leader in warfare and in art and in culture and everything. And England was definitely not at his level. And it was not until this time, in the middle of the 18th century, that England moved ahead. And this was actually, and I don't think that many books have taken this on, this is actually very hard for France to accept. And that's where you get some of the espionage and the stress between the two countries. And then what you'll have 10 years later, or 12 years later, is the French deciding to back the American colonists. You know, it's purely spite. There's nothing in the French leadership at that time that supported Republican efforts. And by that, I mean a republic. You know, they were such monarchists, but they hated the English so much that they wanted to make their lives miserable. So they backed the George Washington. But back in my book, what's happening, and I found actual cases of this, is that there was technically no war anymore. The war had been France, more or less, they didn't really surrender. They just signed a series of treaties and they gave up a lot of their territory. And so England is on top, but the French are not happy about it. And there really was an edict from King Louis XV to his diplomats and anybody who's in England. And there was no barrier to going to England because they're not at war anymore, right across the channel. It is every Frenchman's duty to interfere with the pretensions of the English. So they had this mission, and there was a man who was, you know, it could be pretty serious looking at the military defenses of England and where they had the most money going and the most resources. And he was smuggling that information out, and he was actually caught and he was tried and he was hanged. So it was a real thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, let's talk about some of the characters here besides Genevieve Planchet. That you had your cast of characters. Amazing. Amazing. So I want to start with a, I'm just going to name the character.
Sure.
And I'm going to start with a antagonist. Hervé Guénard.
Yes. I came up with a real nasty one there.
Yeah. And another one of the people that's doing a lot of manipulation in the background, that our plucky heroine has no idea what's going on at the beginning.
Right. Right.
So talk about Hervé.
So he is someone who is taking advantage of something that is very little known, which is that in France at that time, in Paris, you had a very aggressive secret police. And you had a lot of conditions that the criminals were straining against. And in London, you had almost none. They just didn't have a police force yet. And so it was seen as a place of opportunity. There were some master French criminals who were melting into the society in London in the 1760s to take advantage of this fact that they could move with greater ease. So he's someone who, and I based him on some real people from research, who's a lot of, he's many things, many bad things.
Purveyor of women?
Yes, yes, yes.
A spy?
Yeah.
But is rubbing shoulders, with the aristocracy at the same time.
Yes, definitely. And he makes, well, I mean, and this was mirrored in France. I mean, King Louis XV, his last mistress, Madame du Barry, was involved with the du Barry family. She married one of their brothers, and they were aristocratic criminals. There were these kinds of people in the 18th century. By the time of the Victorian age and then after the French Revolution, you really didn't have this as much. But there were some very shady people with titles after their names. Now, Hervé is not exactly titled himself, although he was brought up, you know, well. But he knows a little about a lot of things, but he is always looking for opportunity. He's greedy, he's amoral, and he's not stupid. So he's he's not easy to go up against. So I tried, that's what I tried to do. I tried to create somebody who was going to be, my character would have to use all of her resources to try and not be defeated by him. And he would like to defeat her.
and so he's also trying to bring in her husband, trying to manipulate her husband, Thomas Sturbridge.
Right.
So we have two potential victims and historical figure he's accompanied by.
Yep.
Giacomo Casanova.
Yes. Well, I mean, I maybe everybody else was aware of this, but I went into this just thinking Casanova was a famous romantic figure, and I didn't know about his criminal history, which was considerable. And in England, he was actually arrested for some of his crimes. And he was, like a lot of the characters in my book, going for a bit of a con. You know, and he actually did try to convince a very rich French noblewoman that he could give her immortality if she would just keep financing his efforts. You know, it's a little bit, I don't know if you've seen this show, Bad Vegan, on Netflix.
No, but, I haven't seen it.
This woman was a very prestigious chef in Manhattan, was conned by a man she ended up marrying, who said that he could give her and her dog immortality. So you see, it's been going on for a long time. So I tried to weave in alchemy, which is something that I first started writing about in my first books, because in the 16th century, alchemy and necromancy were very much part of, you know, sort of the flip side of some of the monastic and Catholic orders, you know, some of this darker stuff. And it really still was bubbling along in the 18th century. But it was starting to change into chemistry. The word alchemy was turning into chemistry. And also people were starting to think, you know, and Mary Shelley captured this in Frankenstein, that that some of these answers in science could be great philosophical revelations for all of us. You know, it was a time where science was exciting, but not very well understood yet, which is kind of a dangerous time.
There's a term used in a book in the novel where people thought electricity could be the spark of life.
Yes, yes.
And then, you know, then I thought about Frankenstein.
Right, right.
And it's like, wow. So we went from my original thought of alchemy from school was turning lead into gold.
Right, right.
But here it's sort of in your novel, and I guess during this historical period, it was being defined in a much broader way, sort of the pursuit of, as you said, of immortality, the elixir of life they were looking for.
Philosopher's Stone. Yeah. J.K. Rowling, she seized on something that, you know, in her books that was actually very, very real at that time. Now, within about 50, 60 more years, it really did die down, because as the French Revolution and the American way of life, and, you know, a lot of it was, we have to be able to prove things through experiment, and we have to read great thinkers, and, you know, some of this magic stuff just sort of died down. But at this point, it was still very much a factor. And I found that interesting that, like, you know, you had some of the great philosophers, Voltaire, Rousseau, going, but at the same time, there was all this other stuff too. And it was all sort of in the same pot. You know, and people were had all kinds of interesting beliefs. But yeah, they thought that, and in fact, this is in the book Frankenstein, and a lot of these people, these poor eels, they kept trying to electrify the eels as part of their experiment, thinking that, like, they would be able to show that electricity could bring an eel back to life. So it could bring anyone back to life, you know. So it's kind of, it seems ridiculous to us now, but they were taking it quite seriously then.
Now, Joshua Reynolds is a famous artist at the time and takes an interest in Genevieve. And talk a little bit about how important it was, if you were an aspiring artist, to have the artist, the leading artist, take an interest in you, because they would normally say, who's to use a, you know, a current term, who's up next?
Yes. Well, they there was a big show in London a few years ago of Joshua Reynolds, in which they said that it's possible he was the person who pretty much coined our idea of what a celebrity is. Thanks. No. But the portrait painters had always been there for the royals and for the rich. But what he started to do was to go after not just the royals, but the beautiful people, the actors, the courtesans, you know, the beautiful young prostitutes who were getting a huge income from their lovers, and generals. He started to broaden it, and he made his paintings so dynamic and exciting that people were sort of jostling to see them, and then they wanted to be next. So it started to feed on itself. And, you know, before that, England did not have a lot of its own artists. You know, they were really, you know, like you had Hans Holbein coming over from Germany, you had other people, but Reynolds was part of the first group with Thomas Gainsborough and Romney of English-born artists who came up through, they fought their way up, they became wealthy. It wasn't easy though, and there are a lot of sharp elbows. What I found really interesting is that whether you're talking about William Hogarth, Joshua Reynolds, Thomas Gainsborough, none of these people came from well-off families at all. And almost none of them had any artists in their families. So they had to really invent themselves, which I found interesting. It's not what you think of. And then they had some... They had some rough edges, to say the least. I read one book about the artists in London and how, you know, they were seen as not gentlemen. They were not nice to women. They were exploitive of women. They were I wouldn't say that they were like attacking or stealing from each other, but they were extremely competitive. So we just think of artists as sort of, you know, Manet or, you know, very, decorous, very well-mannered. And back in the 18th century, it was like a mosh pit of ambitious people, you know, trying to hoist themselves up out of nothing. You know, there were no scholarships. There was nothing like that. You had to probably go hungry a few nights, you know, when you're starting out, till you could get your commissions up. And then you had to build your reputation, be your own publicist. And he was the person who kind of, he was the founder of the Royal Academy in England. He doesn't have the greatest reputation now. And I mean, I don't want to give away too much in my book, but some of his paintings have not stood the test of time as well as other artists' paintings. Also, the fact is that he always wanted to paint the wealthiest and the most established and the most famous people. And so, you know, that doesn't stand up so well next to an artist who maybe wanted subjects that would, I don't know, stand on their own as artistic subjects. You know what I mean? He was using it so much to be sort of the it person in London, you know, and he knew everybody. He went out every night. He was always out, but he wasn't much partying because he was a party machine, is to meet people looking for the next commission, the next contact. So a very interesting sort of hustler. I don't know who to compare. He's not like Andy Warhol, but he, you know, he was using his undeniable talent to try it with enormous ambition.
How would you say the character changed Genevieve Planché, besides being married, besides it feels like she's in a dead end job? You know, she's going through the motions, has her little shop. Her husband's a teacher. Mm-hmm. He's struggling. He's off doing his own thing. How would you say that character has developed from the blue to where it is in the novel?
One of the reasons I wanted to write this book is that often when you read a thriller, at the end, when the good guys have vanquished the bad guys, to make it very simple, when you have the ending, there's just this feeling that now everything's going to be great. And, you know, I thought in this instance, what would be the second part to being, she really was in the blue. She did commit an act that is a crime, you know, espionage, industrial espionage. And her husband did too. So I wanted to know what would be the consequences of this. And so I sort of really worked on that and thought it through and did some research. And she's back in England with her husband, but they're not the toast of the town. They're sort of in disgrace and they have to rehabilitate themselves. And he's forbidden from doing a lot of the great scientific work that he did before he got mixed up with Genevieve, because he's not trusted, you know, because he did work for the French. So, and then what I was trying to get at with their marriage is that he is, I don't know if you would call him a genius, but he is extremely brilliant, but his head is in the clouds sometimes. And he doesn't always think of where's the money going to come from for dinner.
Right.
But somebody has to think about that. And even though those are not the kinds of things that you usually see in historical suspense, sort of the more prosaic strains of life, I decided to weave that into her situation, that she is the
primary breadwinner.
She is. And she has a child, and she's not really able to raise her child herself. And she can't, I mean, not to be too anachronistic here, but like she can't afford great childcare. You know, so she's not happy with the way things are, but like many people, when you get in a situation, you're not really happy with the way things are working out, but like, it's not always obvious how to make it better. It's kind of like, this is what you have. And so she is more or less making the best of it. And then suddenly comes this opportunity that perhaps she will get what she wanted throughout the blue, what she's always wanted, which is an opportunity to be an artist, to be taken seriously, to have opportunities. And, you know, let's face it, like all artists, you know, to have some fame, to have some attention. And, you know, that's been her very quietly held hope. And and she thought that she'd sort of stomped it out, but it turns out it was not completely stomped out. And it's, you know, it's exciting to think that it's not too late, that she can chase her dream.
So how do you give agency to a character like Genevieve in a time where the society is trying to take away as much agency as possible from women? More on top of the class issue.
Right. Well, she's a fiery, defiant person, and she has a temper. Sometimes, you know, she really lashes out. Other times she tries to think and be resourceful and to sort of use, you know, the hand she's been dealt here. I mean, late in the book, she decides that she's in a very bad situation with her own life and her husband's, and everything's being pretty much ruined. And so she tries to use her knowledge of the art world to aid the men in an official investigation, but trying to like help herself too. And, you know, that is the kind of sort of solution that a woman like her, you know, that would be kind of the only way you could go. You know what I mean? Try to figure out who's in charge. What do they need? Do I have something that they could use? And then I don't want them to just use me. I want to get something out of it. You know, that's the kind of situation that she finds herself in, which is very tough.
So last character I want you to talk about as much as you can, Sam Baldwin.
Oh, right. Well,
another manipulator on the scene.
Something funny about him. You know, he's one of the people who started out as a tiny character, and he grew a little bit. And then I have two people who read my books in sections, and then they read it at the end. I just like to get their sense, you know, beta readers. But also, I met one of them in a workshop. And the reason I do this is that when I write, sometimes what's in my head is not 100% what's on the page. And I don't know that until someone, you know what I mean?
Yes.
That's something a writer has to contend with, that, you know, are you really pulling off what you think you are? So they were reading it, and both of them confessed to me how much they like Sam. They almost had crushes on Sam. And it's like, this isn't the first time this has happened to me. I have a problem with my characters where I lose control. And sometimes the one that I think is the one that people would find admirable and maybe desirable. I'm not saying that people hate him, but they like this one over here and I think, oh, what happened? So it's kind of, I find that very funny that they get out of control, but I can't give away his big secret.
Of course.
But I did again, base him on a group of people in England who, you know, as you must know, have done some damage to the world. But he himself is not, well, it's, I can't get into it anymore, except that I'll say that there were these sort of, I can't say he's sort of a wannabe. The art world was so exciting at this time that there were people who were trying to get into it and trying to be painters, whether they had the talent or the unbelievable drive that was necessary to succeed. I mean, are you willing to work 7 days a week, 14 hours a day to achieve your dream? A lot of people aren't. But he is part of this this circle of I call it society, you know, like there's artists, there's musicians, there's people in the government, there, and there's a lot of actors, because theater was very big then. It was an opera. Performing arts were just something that everybody loved and tried to participate in as much as possible, in a way that I wish it was happening now, but theater was very important. So he's part of that. And these two just click in their sort of their mindset, and sort of like they get the same jokes. I mean, we've all met people like that just out of the blue.
And but wait a minute, she's married.
I know. And I'm not going to say anymore. But that's the thing, is that, and I think this, that maybe people can relate to this. I don't know. But a great marriage also has history. And sometimes the history has some guilt and some stress. And so someone brand new could seem exciting. That's all I'll say.
But
I don't want people to think that she's, you know, out there, you know, being a terrible adulteress.
I mean, we already talked about, you know, Hervé Guénard.
I know.
Audience, I'm just joking. No, she wasn't out there like that.
Oh, no.
But no, this novel with the history, with giving sort of this street level view of what that world was like in 1764, the espionage that was going on, how famous artists operated, how the patrons operated, how the powerful aristocrats were pursuing eternity, life, you know, immortality, all the schemes that people were engaging in. I mean, this is just such a kaleidoscope of that fits so well together. I have to tell you, I just really, really enjoyed The Fugitive Colors by Nancy Bilyeu.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, Nancy, for once again being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
I really enjoyed talking to you. This has been a real highlight of my day, my weekend.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.